Okay, so welcome everybody to the sixth in an ongoing series of 10 lectures on the halachic process and the question as to how halacha adapts to fit modern times. We've covered a lot of ground so far in the first five classes, and I'd like to shift focus a little bit now into something related but different, but something that we really need to get to the bottom of. Before I start, may I just bring to your attention two things. Number one, this is the last class before Pesach, I'm sure you're aware of that. Classes are resuming 2 days after Pesach, on the Wednesday after Pesach. Yom Tov is on Monday and the class is on Wednesday. I myself will not be here that day. I have to fly to England to go see my parents. I apologize that I won't be there. Have you used the royal wedding, correct? No, I don't actually. They didn't ask me to say one of the Sheva Brachas. I'll live with it. The Chief Rabbi is going, but I'm not. So I won't be here, and I don't know who will be, but there will be classes that day. Certainly the first and the third class, and hopefully someone in the middle as well. Be'ezrat Hashem, I will resume from the week after to finish the course. The second piece of information is that, yes. Yeah, well, it's meant to be a ten class series anyway, and there were 11 classes originally scheduled. So I think that there'll be 10 by the time we finish. Okay? I want to just bring to your attention two things on the board here. They're not necessary for you, behind you. They're not absolutely essential. But number one is this. This web address is a website that I have that is in the process of undergoing a certain amount of change. There is a little bit of stuff up there at the moment, but you are able, if you're interested or your friends are interested, to access all of the sheets and all of the shiurim of this class so far on this website, which will soon link in with the first one. So you need this second one just for now, but soon you will only need the first one and it will go straight through. But all five recordings and five sheets from our existing course are up there for access. The recordings as well and the sheets. Be'ezrat Hashem, within a process of 2 or 3 months, there'll be lots and lots and lots of other stuff up there too, of mine, if you're interested. So that's something just to watch out for the future. Now, let's have a look at this sheet. I want to move now from the global vision of how halacha does appear to have changed, as we've seen, in many, many areas, in scientific areas, in technological areas, in social areas, and sometimes it has not changed, and we've looked at some of the processes of how it did and how it didn't. I'd like to now look at the issue of how does a poisek pasken halacha, which is simply an obvious question. But like many things that we live around, have around us, we most people don't want to kind of just unscrew the front of the CD player to find out how all the wiring works. They're just happy to press play, and it plays. But if we do want to get an understanding as to how PSAC works, I think we need to unscrew the front of the CD player a little bit and have a look at the wiring. And what I've done today is I've brought you a number of approaches. Actually, they're all coming from the same kind of approach, but I want to try and put them together. The people who really talk about this, in my experience, and I'll be happy to receive other ideas of other sources if you have them, are the students of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik himself, that we're going to be looking at. Also, the sheet's just behind you here. Just here. If anyone doesn't have a sheet, it's down here. We'll be seeing Rav Herschel Schechter, of course, who's one of the main Talmidim of Rav Soloveitchik. We'll be seeing Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who is also ditto. And we'll also be hearing from someone a little bit younger, who is Rabbi Dr. Michael Broyd, who is perhaps the next generation down of people who is on the RCA, who is also part of that whole school of thought. And maybe next time we'll hear a little bit from Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz as well. But for now, let's have a look at this. Now, how... Yes?
...taking everyone from the central...
So the answer to your question is we can look at examples from Rav Moshe's Psak as to how he paskens, but I'm not aware of a detailed discussion by him analyzing how he paskens. That's what I'm trying to get to here. I'm trying to not just look at what people say and then try and put together why they said it, but look at what people say about how they make the decisions that they make. You see what I mean? I think very much in the more Haredi world, this is almost like an intuitive process. I'm not aware of any detailed analysis by that world as to how that works. There may be. I just need to find it. If you do know where that is, then please tell me. But in Rav Soloveitchik, of course, there is for the first time, really, a very detailed analysis as to the methodology and philosophy of halacha. As you are, I'm sure, aware, Rav Soloveitchik wrote two very major works on the philosophy and methodology of halacha, more the philosophy, which are Halachic Man, which is here, which is a must. It's not a hard read, it's an essential read. It's a short book, about 150 pages, and it's something that you can look at over the Pesach break. And also Halachic Mind, because I know you've got nothing else to do over the Pesach break, right? When your husbands are cleaning, family's cleaning, you can sit and read Halachic Man. I think that'll be an interesting new chiddush. What's that? I don't give psak halacha, Esther, you know that. You have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi. The other book that I recommend, but is much harder to read, is Halachic Mind, which very much is a philosophical work, which demands to some degree an understanding of the background of philosophy and philosophical approach. But they're both essential reads in many ways, and we're going to see a little bit from all of them now. How objective is halacha? When people paskin halacha, to what extent is the personality of the rabbi deciding the halacha? This is really what I'm trying to get to today, which is a very important question. The first four sources will seem to indicate that the answer is not very much. There's an objective halacha, and we're going to take that further. I want to use an example, a very interesting and somewhat controversial one, which is number one. Tashma, Da'ama, Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish says in the Gemara in Yevamos, Tav lemeitiv tandu, milemeitiv armelu. A woman would rather live in a marriage together with other people than live on her own. You familiar with this source? Please take a sheet here. What is the relevance to this halachic maxim? The question is as follows. If a person marries and the marriage turns out to be based on entirely false assumptions, to what extent is that marriage still a marriage and requires a divorce to terminate it? And to what extent is it just a mistake and therefore is not a marriage at all and therefore does not require a divorce because the whole thing was just obviously a major error? Let's first take a commercial example. Obviously, marriage is not a commercial deal only. It's also a commercial financial deal. But let's take a commercial example. If you go to a shop and you buy a washing machine and you pay the money and they deliver it next door and you open up the next day and they open up the package and it's a dishwasher, you obviously don't owe anyone any money. It's the whole thing's just a mistake. You don't own a dishwasher. You don't have to say, well, we have to sell back the dishwasher. It's nonsense. Just phone them up and say, take this away and bring me a washing machine or call the whole thing off. There's no deal here. Similarly, please take a sheet from here. If you marry a man, let's say, and let's take an extreme example, and when you get home from the wedding, you find out it's a completely different person, as in Rachel Leah kind of syndrome. Obviously, there's no divorce required there. You married somebody, and the person that you found you were married to is a completely different man. Obviously, not married to him. It's what you call a mekach tas. It's a completely false deal. The shaila is, how far does that go? What happens if you marry a man and later on you find that he's already married to two other women? Is that a fundamental flaw of the marriage? What happens if you marry a person and you find out afterwards that he's not a very nice person and you thought he was? What happens if you find out actually he's violent and you didn't know that before the marriage? This, of course, is something which is not totally unheard of. So what happens if you find he's sterile? Or in the tshuvas of Rav Moshe, if you found that the man was actually incapable of undergoing a marital relationship or whatever, for whatever reason. So does the marriage still exist, or is the marriage now finished? Does it need a get, or is it just a nothing? Because it's just a zero. Like someone who married a man and they turned out they're a completely different person. That's the question, and It opens up the quite controversial question of Hafkas Kiddushin. To what extent can we just uproot the Kiddushin and tear up the Kiddushin and say goodbye, just walk away from each other? And to what extent do we need to get? Now, I'm not getting into the substantive question of Hafkas Kiddushin, although it was a very controversial question and it has been a very controversial question in many circles. Maybe we'll touch on it next time. But the statement, Toiv Lemeitiv Tanduma Lemeitiv Armalu, indicates that actually a woman in many situations would prefer to be in a married state even to somebody who was not the person she thought she would be married to than to turn around and say, I would rather be single than married to this man. Now, to what extent that applies in practice, I'm not getting into now. Maybe we'll touch on it. But it does introduce something of a presumption that in the woman's case, the marriage is valid, even in stressful or difficult circumstances, whereas maybe in the man's case, it will be not so. Now, it introduces that question. And the question is really what we're dealing with today, is to what extent is that just a statement of Chazal based on sociological realities 2,000 years ago? Obviously, the social reality of women 2,000 years ago was entirely different from today. They had no means of independent income on the whole. If they were not married, they were prone to abuse of different kinds by different people. There was no life, really, for most women as independent single people. It was marriage or, you know, rejection on many levels. To what extent do we say, well, of course, that statement in the Gemara here is a socially contextual statement, and today doesn't apply this way, and therefore women would prefer to be single, the marriage is not a marriage, or do we not say that? And again, I'm not getting into the question so much, but I want to look at two statements of Rav Soloveitchik. Have a look at Rav Soloveitchik number two. Says Rav Soloveitchik the following. This was delivered in a sermon to the RCA in 1975, in an address to the RCA. This has absolutely nothing to do with the social and political status of the woman in antiquity. The chazaka, this presumption number one, that a woman would prefer to be married even if the marriage is not desirable, the chazaka is not based on sociological factors, but on a verse in Bereishis. And your desire shall be to your husband. The verse, the pasuk says that women wish to be connected with their husbands. It is not a psychological fact. It is an existential fact. And we'll see what he means a bit later. To say that Tav Lemeitiv Tandum Lemeitiv Armalu was due to the inferior political or social status of women at the time is simply misunderstanding the chazaka. Not only the halachas, but also the chazakas of our sages of blessed memory introduced are indestructible. You must not tamper, not only with the halachas, but even with the chazakas. For the chazakas spoke not upon transient psychological behavioral patterns, but on permanent ontological principles, ontological, the nature of being, okay, rooted in the very depths of the metaphysical human personality, which is as changeless as the heavens above. Now, Rav Soloveitchik is making a very clear stand. He's drawing a very clear line that don't put halacha into a social, a historical context, and then seek to change it today. And the reason he's doing that is because there's pressure from the world in which he lived, and even more so now, to do exactly that. And we'll look at some of that pressure in Es Hashem in Shir 8. Okay? It's the same thing. The fact that women today earn $100,000 a year and there's a completely viable life for a woman as a single woman is irrelevant. So the question as to whether her marriage is a halakhic marriage and can be terminated without a divorce is irrelevant. Now, before we turn around and say, well, Rav Soloveitchik does not admit any social context at all, let's put that question on hold because Rav Lichtenstein later is going to address this question of Rav Soloveitchik and say, you mustn't misunderstand the Rav here. He's not saying quite what it sounds like he's saying, and we'll deal with that when we get there. Yes. To what? And it's not saying it's a command. It's saying it's a statement of halachic reality. It's a fact. It's not even a fact of human nature. It's a fact of halachic nature. And therefore, when you have a halachic question, this is the only relevant fact, so we see from here. And of course, there are women who hate their husbands. The halacha is not saying that every woman is decreed that every woman loves her husband to pieces. That you can't say that. It's an emotional question. But he's saying it's irrelevant. If you're asking me a halachic question, is this woman married or is this woman not married? That is not an emotional, psychological, or social question. That is a halachic question. The halachic question has a halachic answer, which is unconnected, perhaps, with the social, psychological, or emotional reality. And that, to a certain degree, is the subject matter of halachic man. Well, let's just work forward with the principle. Let me give you a quote from Halachic Mind in number 3. Objectification reaches its highest expression in the halacha. Halacha is the act of seizing the subjective flow and converting it into enduring and tangible magnitudes. It is the crystallization of the fleeting individual experience. Okay, you know something? One of the challenges of reading Rav Soloveitchik is, of course, you just have to have a bunch of words in your vocabulary. I expect to some degree that my audience here will be more familiar with the way that Rav Soloveitchik writes than a bunch of 18-year-old SEM girls who would no doubt look at me in total blankness and say, I've never seen anything like this before. My assumption is that you do come from a background where this kind of style is more accessible, but I agree, it's a little bit difficult. Truth is, these three lines are not very difficult. Yes. The fact that you're said by them means you understood them, that's for sure. Yes, he's dehumanizing halacha. No question. In short, halacha is the objectifying instrument of our religious consciousness. Now, this is a hard sentence. The form principle of the transcendental acts, which means the actions of the world beyond this world. This is what crystallizes them. The matrix in which the amorphous religious halo is cast. Don't worry about it. But was it? Oh yeah. Back to Sam. But what he is saying, hopefully you can understand here, is that halacha does not exist in a subjective social context. Halacha exists out there somehow, transcendentally, in a fixed objective framework. And the world fits around halacha, and halacha does not fit around the world. And where he's coming from is a very classic Kabbalistic, in many ways. And don't forget, the Rav came from even though he's from himself a very rational school of thought, he came from the Briskers. He came from the world of the Nefesh HaChaim, of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, and his heritage is from there. And to some degree, I think this idea is very much connected with the Zohar number 4, which is Kutcha Brichu Istakel Be'araisa Ubara Alma. HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked into the halacha to create the world, meaning the halacha, look, the Torah, existed on some level independently and prior to the world, and the world was created around the halacha rather than the other way around. Then subsequently, Barnash, human beings, Mistakel Babaraisa, now look into the Torah, Umakayim Alma, and they sustain the world. Just like a Kodesh Baruch Hu looked into this pre-existing objective information, as it were, and creates the world. So the Rav, the Paisek, looks into the same objective world, and now objective halacha, and sustains the world. Now, what I want to really do is... Well, let's see. Let's before we judge the individual, let's have a look and see how his Talmidim understand his position. Okay, and by the way, I've no reason to think that the Haredi philosophy on halacha is any different to this. I'm not aware that it is any different to this. What's this? That's because you have a preconception of what the word Haredi means, which may be incorrect. He means that it's not a subjective, everything's flexible kind of approach, but I don't think that's the modern Orthodox approach to Paschini Halacha either, at all. I think that's a misunderstanding. Yes. In halacha or in hashkofa? We're talking about halakha here. We're talking about mutter and osa. And that may be a different kind of world to the more, the broader... Right. Okay, and there will be a connection. And to some degree, the connection will be dealt with next time for reasons that we'll see in a minute. Yes. We'll deal with that soon. We'll deal with that. Okay, let's go. We have a long way to go. We have 55 minutes to go. And we have a lot of information to deal with. Now, have a look at Rav Lichtenstein. I must apologize to you in advance. I've brought four or five rather lengthy passages from Rav Lichtenstein, which we're going... There's a lot of English on this sheet, because a lot of the material that's written on this is in English. And I'm sure you won't mind that too much. Let's have a look at Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein's major work on this subject was an essay in Tradition magazine called The Human and Social Factor in Halacha. It appears in volume 36 of Tradition, which is around about 7 or 8 years ago, I can't remember exactly. And this is what he says. Have a look at the bottom, number 5. Hurrah! And this is extremely refreshing in that it is an analysis of how this whole system works. Okay. Hurrah! Number 5 is comprised of two elements. Hurrah is the word, Torah is the word for psak. Okay, halach is two elements. And I want you to think of these two elements now for the rest of today's class and try and work out which one we're talking about when we're talking. Psak and psika, respectively. The former relates to codification, the formulation of the law pertinent to a given area, and is most characteristically manifested in the adoption on textual or logical grounds of one position in preference to another. As such, it is essentially the concluding phase of the learning process proper, whether on a grand or narrow scale, and its locus is the base of medrash. In other words, psak is the analysis of the halachic sources to try and work out technically, it's a technical process, how does the halacha come out? And we will analyze what that technical process is and where is the room for chidush in that technical process. But psak is a technical process. Getting to the bottom line halacha. There's a lot of material in front of the posek, precedents, svarim, his own shimush with his rebbeim. How does he get to psak? Now, on the next page, this is a continuation. Psika, by contrast, denominates implementation. And Rav Lichtenstein has divided, therefore, the halakhic process into two systems. There's psak, which is perhaps removed from the practical implications of the case and is more of a theoretical process. And then there's psika. It bespeaks the application of what has already been forged in the crucible of the learning experience to a particular situation. In other words, you've already formed a psak. Now let's work out how that psak affects this person. In this person's individual cases, it does not entail the definitive postulation of the law governing a delimiting area or its detail. In other words, I'm not trying to work out what the law is here, but rather the concurrent and coordinate meshing of all aspects possibly drawn from wide diverging spheres obtaining in a concrete situation. Which means that I now have to build into the question of this person, Shaila, a whole bunch of other external factors, which are halachic factors, but which are not technical factors for the psak. Its venue is publicly the Beis Din, because this is what Beis Din does. Beis Din doesn't paskin in a vacuum. They don't say, I don't want to know anything about you, anything about your circumstances, anything about your background. I'm just going to give you a psak min hashamayim. They don't say that. They sit and they listen to this one arguing, and then that one arguing, and this one says, but what about this, and what about this? And they're very meshed into the individual case. Or privately, the meeting of inquirer and respondent. It does not necessarily demand of the posik that he takes a stand or break fresh ground. Its challenge lies in the need to harness knowledge and responsibility at the interface of reality and halacha. So now what Rav Lichtenstein is talking about is a halachic process which is divorced from reality, which is technical, and the implementation of a halachic process which is now rooted in reality. Let's look at this woman's real situation. Let's look at this person's real problem. And let's see how... Now, what factors do we bring into psika that will change, perhaps, the bottom line as to how there are paskins? And that's what we're going to look at in this next section now, and the more we'll look at that next time. Yes?
Two people go to the same rabbi and come back and say, we have the same question we got.
Right. Because of psika. That's what he's going to say. The psak
is going to be the same in both, because it's just the Rav's analysis of the halachic situation. Although we'll see that different Rabbonim are going to come to different Muksak for reasons that we're going to see. Actually, that's not the trouble. That is the essence of halacha. We'll see. Whereas Psika really is going to depend. This person goes for Shaila and the answer is Posel, and this one says Kosher. Now, let's have a look at number 6. We'll see now. The cogency and legitimacy of a, quote, human, unquote, approach to Psak appears to many problematic. They would have us believe that the ideal Posek is a faceless, heartless supercomputer into whom all of the relevant data is fed and who then produces the right answer. Should this standard not be met, the shortfall is to be regarded as a failing, the lamentable result of human frailty, which may be the impression that you got from the Rav Soloveitchik. It's almost like a kind of a mathematical formula. You plug in all the details, and you come up with an answer, and I don't care who you are, where you're from, this is the answer. Says Rav Lichtenstein, that's not true, and he's going to address the Rav's position soon. On this reading, the process of psika properly conceived and executed bears no semblance, in other words, if you're going to be heartless and faceless, bears no semblance to the existential encounter between seeker and respondent. It entails, rather, the application of a text to a problem, the coupling of a code and a situation. This conception does not necessarily preclude reckoning with a specific circumstance of the question and the questioner, as these may well be relevant to the objective data. In other words, it's not that I ignore the details. I don't ignore the details on this very kind of objective approach. The prevailing tendency, however, will be to dwarf this factor as to the human, and as to the human aspect of the meshiv, that will be obviated entirely. In other words, the human quality of the Rav on this understanding would be irrelevant. He, for his part, is to be animated by the precept that we do not have mercy in judgment, and hence to pass on the merits of the issue with imperviously stony objectivity. Now, purist proponents of this approach often cry it up as the frum view of psikha. In other words, the less human the Rav is, the frummer he is. That, he says, is a perception. In reality, however, this portrait of a Posek is a mere caricature. Limed, and I didn't know what the word limed meant, and had to look it up. Limbed? Yes, that's exactly what it means. I admit my own ignorance, I've never used the word before. Limbed by those who, at most, karu v'shanu, means they learned technically in the yeshiva, but certainly loy shimshu. They never did Shimush Rabbonim. And this is a very critical point. He says that if you're asking your shilas to people who learned their halacha in a Beis HaMedrash, you are going to get psak and not psika. Yeah. You are going to get an answer which is based in a technical world of halacha without experience of how real halachic questions are connected with real people. That's psika. And therefore, when you're asking your shilas to people, I'm not talking about, by the way, shilas which are simple shilas. You know, I drop my plastic spoon in my milkic washing up. Does not need a world posek to answer. You can pick someone out of yellow pages, yeah, and you can ask them. If you even need to ask someone that question, I'm talking about questions which really go to the roots of a person's life. You know, questions which are very very meaningful and important to them. Questions on contraception, for example, which obviously are very critical. A person turns around to a Rav and says, you know, I've had 5 babies in the last 7 years and I'm completely worn out. I don't want to have any more babies for the next few years, at least. Is that mutter or is that awesome? Now, you can't pick someone out of yellow pages to ask that question. And therefore, someone who you ask has to be someone who did shimush. My own Rabbonim, my own Rav Muvhak, really, in London, did extensive shimush with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He sat with him for years, and he watched as he paskened people shilas. He drove him in the car as he, you know, spoke to people in the back. He listened, he observed. And that's how you do Shimush Rabbonim. And that's how you learn psikah, he says. And as someone pointed out, that may be the difference between asking a Rav and a Rosh Yeshiva. A Rosh Yeshiva doesn't always exist in a world of Shimush, of psikah. He often exists in a more kind of rarefied world of psak. We'll see. As anyone who has been privileged to observe Gedolim at close hand can readily attest, they approach Psak doubly animated by responsibility to Halacha and sensitivity to human concerns. The balance between norm and need may be variously struck. In other words, there are different balances. Some people are more on the Pesach side and less on the human side, and some people are more. There are certainly ideological differences amongst poskim as to how much weight to assign the human factor. In principle, however, recognition of this factor is the rule rather than the exception. And in my humble opinion, I don't think this has got anything to do with Haredi, non-Haredi. I think there are people in all Jewish worlds who come from different backgrounds on this. And you will get people, famously, you will get people who say, Rav Shlomo Zalman would always say such and such. And you have other people in that world, Rav Eliashiv, who have a different approach and a different perspective. And similarly, in the world of the modern Orthodox world, I don't think it's a divide of hashkofa. I think it's a divide of halachic approach. Now, I don't want to get bogged down in lots and lots of English, and I'm going to, you know, recommend that you read some of this yourself. Basically, what he talks about in number 7 is what are the factors that affect psika. And we're going to talk more about these next time, but let me just raise it for now. While, of course, for the committed Jew, halacha as a normative order can never be superseded by external pressure, and we'll get to that more in a minute, a specific halacha may be flexibly applied and, in a sense, superseded by the internal dynamics of the halachic system proper. And this in two distinct reliable ways. The first entails recourse to a phalanx of factors of human and social import which affect decision as acknowledged halachic elements. This is what I want to call meta-halacha. And again, stay with what we're trying to do here. Meta halacha means there are halachic factors which I need to bring into account to get to my final answer in psika. And what are these? At the apex stands, of course, pikuach nefesh, but other factors, local or general of lesser gravity, also abound. Physical and psychological pain, financial hardship, social harmony, human dignity, sensitivity to any or all of which can affect a psak measurably. In other words, he says that there are factors, big halachic factors, which will come into play when I want to paskin a halacha. These are what I call meta halacha. We'll talk about these next time. How do you balance a technical question versus kovod habrius, human dignity? How do you balance that? And we'll see different people balance that in different ways. This is all Rav Lichtenstein so far. We'll be moving away from him in a minute. He's not even talking about that now. He's not even talking about that. That's more of an external factor which we'll get to. Just skip to the second paragraph. But then he talks about psak. And we're going to talk a little bit more about psak soon. In fact, now. Which is as follows. Just looking at the technical angle of psak, without coming onto these external sort of individual factors. How does that work? And he says the following. The latitude is grounded in the pluralistic aspects of halacha. The halachic system comprises three distinct tiers, and this is a very interesting analysis. There is first an ideal and presumably monistic plane. What does he mean by monistic? Right, the opposite of pluralistic. One approach, okay? There is one, the top is this monistic plane, the Torah which is Bashamayim. And this raises your question of Lo Bashamayim, which we'll get to right now. It is to this that the Gemara in Bava Metzia alludes when it ascribes to the Ribbono Shel Olam a position with respect to an issue in Taharas. What does God think about this? That's the first layer. There is at the final stage the definitive corpus, the genre of the Shulchan Aruch, which having decided amongst various view posits, again monistically, what is demanded by the Jew. In other words, at the top level, there's a sort of a non-pluralistic level, and at the bottom, there's a non-pluralistic level, which is the final psak, which is not the psika, but which is the psak. Intermediately, however, there is the vibrant and entrancing world, and this is what we're going to talk about now, which within which exegetical debate and analytical controversy are the order of the day, and within which divergent and even contradictory views are equally accredited. The operative assumption is that inherently and imminently the raw material of Torah is open to diverse interpretations. The Gedolei Israel, all fully committed and conscientiously and responsibly applying their talents and their knowledge to the elucidation of texts and problems, may arrive at different conclusions. License having been given to them to engage in the quest, the results all attain the status of Torah as a tenable variant reading of Dvar Hashem, both these and those are the words of the living God. And let me just now move away from Rav Lichtenstein for a few minutes to try and explain what he's talking about. What he's saying is like this. Leaving aside psika, which is the application to specific circumstances using other meta-halakhic principles, the process of psak itself is open to alternative interpretations. There are people who are more into chidush, And there are people who are less into chidush. And that's even going on in the technical Beis HaMedrash process. And I want to open a little bit the box on how that works. What is chidush and what is not chidush? And again, now I'm not specifically talking about the application to specific circumstances. I'm talking about the general question as to what is allowed and what is not allowed. Maybe we'll go back to Rav Lichtenstein in a few minutes. But for now, just go forward to page 4 and some Hebrew sources. I think we need a little break from the English sources. Let's look at these Hebrew sources. And we're going to go back to Rav Lichtenstein in Yassasha. The role of chiddush in halacha. When is and when is chiddush not applicable? And I want to really root this to the earliest possible beginnings of the halachic process. Have a look at this mission in Pirkei Avos. Chamisha talmidim hayu l'Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ve'elu heim. There were 5 talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and I want to draw your attention to 2 of them specifically. Ve'elu heim. These are they. Rabbi Lezer ben Hurkanus, which is Rabbi Eliezer, the famous Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania, Rabbi Yosef HaKohen, Rabbi Shimon ben Nathanael, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Who haya moinesh shvacham? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to speak about their praises. Look at what he used to say. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus bor is a cistern, seed, which is sealed. She'eino maved tipa. It never loses a drop. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, but Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is ma'ayan hamitgaber, is a never-ending spring. He contrasts these 2 great talmidim of his. One is a cistern that never loses a drop, and one is a spring that never ceases to flow. What is he talking about? He's talking about 2 different approaches, 2 different dynamics in the halachic process. And then at the end, when we try to work out which of these is better, he used to say, in you, kol chachmei Yisrael b'kaf, mos 9. If you put all of the Jewish rabbis, all of Chazal, on one side of a scale, the Eliezer ben Hurkanus, the system that never loses a drop, b'kaf shnei on the other side, machriya et kulam, he'll outweigh all of them. But then Pirkei Avos ends and says, Abba Shaul, Omer Abba Shaul says, no, Mishmoy, and he says, he heard from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in you, kol chachmei Yisrael b'kaf, mos 9, the Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, and even he was with them. The wellspring was on the second one. He would outweigh all of them. So the Pirkei Avos leaves us with an unknown answer. Who is greater? The one who is constantly renewing the process of chidush, the never-ending spring, or the one who just brings down the halacha and never loses a drop? Which is greater? And the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos here leaves us with an uncertainty. 2 different understandings of who is greater. And let's just look into Rabbi Eliezer, the cistern, for a second. Look at number 12. Tan Ravad, Maaseh Rabbi Eliezer she Shabbos beGalil ha'Elin. He spent Shabbos in the Galil. V'sha'alu shloishim halachas beHilchos Sukkah. They asked him 30 halachas in Hilchos Sukkah. 12 of them, he said to his Talmidim, I know the answer to that. Shmoinah, but 18 of them, Amalehem, he said, Loi Shamati. I don't know because I never heard. I never heard. Amalehem, said the Talmidim, said to him, you never said anything that you never heard? What do you think, Rabbi Eliezer? So you never heard, but what do you think? Amalehem, he said to them, his kaktuni. Are you trying to get me to say something that I never heard from my rabbis? I never ever said a psak that I didn't hear from my rebbe. I never said such a thing. Chas v'chalila. That I was going to come up with my own psak? That's not what I do. I don't do that. And therefore you see Rabbi Eliezer's model, if you like, of halacha is one very much of Masorah. I pass them based on how I received Masorah. I'm not here to invent new Masorah. I'm here to transmit faithfully what I received. Rabbi Yeshua, on the other hand, and others, are not like that. Number 13, Tan Rabban. Maaseh Rabbi Yochanan ben Brukah v'Rabbi Elazar chisma, shehalchu lahagbil pnei Rabbi Yeshua pikiin. They went to greet Rabbi Yeshua. Amalehem, he said to them, Ma chidush haya beBeis HaMedrash hayam? What was new? What was the chidush in the Beis HaMedrash today? Amru loy, they said to him, Talmidechanu, we your Talmidim. We drink from your waters. In other words, chiddush? We'll stay over what you told. Tell us. We're not going to be mechadesh. So he answers them, Amalehem, FLP came, look, okay, I know all of that. Can you have a Beit HaMedrash without Chiddush? Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua are two approaches which are in some ways at loggerheads with each other and are inevitably going to reach a clash, which is the system of, I am not going to bring down anything unless I have absolute clear Masorah on that, on the one hand, and Rabbi Yeshua's approach, which was also Rabbi Elazar ben Raph's approach, which was Chiddush, which was this bubbling spring. Ein Beit HaMedrash b'li Chiddush. There must be Chiddush. If there's no Chiddush, there's sterility. How do you balance those two things? Just one second, I need to move on a little bit. And indeed, the classic clash between them came. It came over the question of Loi B'Shamayim Hi, which is the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which Rav Lichtenstein referred to, which I brought you in number 14, which is a very beautiful Gemara, which is very illustrative of what we're trying to do here. Ba'itayon Heshev Rabbi Elazar Kol Tshuva Sheva Oilam 14. V'loy Kiblu Hemenu. Rabbi Elazar gave them all the proofs he had for the Psach Halacha that he wanted to give. Amalahem, he said to them, "Im halacha kemoisi choruv zel yochiach." The carob tree will prove it, and I've cut out the whole middle of this Gemara because you know this Gemara. He brings proof from the carob trees. He brings proof from the river that ran backwards. He brings proof from the walls of the Beis HaMedrash. And in the end, even though they never accepted any of his proofs, he says, "Chazav Amalahem." He eventually said to them, "Im halacha kemoisi min hashamayim yochiach." God will prove it. Yalta Baskol, and a Baskol came out of Amra, Malachem etzer Rabbi Elazar halacha kemoisa b'chol makom. Why are you arguing with Rabbi Elazar? Of course the halacha is like him. A voice from heaven on this, what Rav Lichtenstein says, this monistic plane. There is no plurality in heaven. There is no difference of opinion in Shamayim. Comes out and says, Rabbi Elazar. Amad Rabbi Yeshua al Ragla, v'amar Rabbi Yeshua stood on his feet and said, Loi b'shamayim hi. The halacha is not in Shamayim. Meaning what? We, human beings, are the people that decide halacha, not God. And therefore, given that human beings are always going to be, to some degree, subjective, that has to be how the halacha works. There can't be a pure objectification of halacha. And they rejected Rabbi Eliezer. And indeed, the postscript says, Ashkei Rabbi Nosson Eliyahu, Amalei, so Rabbi Nosson asked Eliyahu Anovi, Mai Avid Kutchabrichu Behahi Shaisa, Amalei, he said to him, what was Hashem doing at the time? Kachayich, he was laughing, Va'amal Nitzchuni Banai Nitzchuni Banai, my children have beaten me, my children have beaten me. The Gemara wants to leave you with a strong flavor that Chiddush, that Loi B'Shamayim Hi, is what is required, rather than Rabbi Eliezer's rather austere approach of I never said anything unless I heard it from my Rebbe. And indeed, there's a little bit of a giveaway in the Gemara in Nida, which says the Kol Yamav, number 15, Kol Yamav shall Rabbi Eliezer hayoisim to Rabbi Yeshua. While Rabbi Eliezer was alive, they didn't allow anyone to paskin like him. All the halacha went like Rabbi Yeshua. By the way, they put Rabbi Eliezer in Cheirim. Everything, every hechsher he ever gave, they reversed. And he died, the Gemara says, a very bitter an unhappy person at the fact that the rabbinic establishment had rejected him. Mishum de Rabbi Eliezer shamutihu. The reason, says the Gemara, is because Rabbi Eliezer was a shamuti. Now, shamuti is a phrase which has a number of meanings. It can mean he was in Cheirim, but Tosfos say, I brought you Tosfos, Pesh Rabbeinu Tam v'Rashbam, shamutihu hainu de havatamidei beishamai. He was from the Talmidim of Shammai. And what you get here is a little bit of a window of the fact that there is built in almost to Judaism these two approaches. There's the Shammai approach, which is a much more traditional, non-Chiddush raced approach. And there is the Hillel approach, which is the Chiddush oriented approach. Built into the fabric of Halacha are these two. We're talking about Psak here. We're not talking about Psak. We're talking about Psak in Psak. Psika will come to more in a minute. Now, I want to just bring to your attention a very beautiful thesis, which I need to speak about for 5 minutes, or maybe even a bit less, of the Netziv. The Netziv, of course, was the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin. We're analyzing here Psak, how Psak works. And he says a very, very beautiful thing. He brings this out over many, many pages. He wrote an introduction to his commentary on the She'iltas. His commentary on the She'iltas was his first major work. It was a work of genius. It really brought him onto the stage, if you like, of one of the great Gedolei Yisrael. And he has an introduction to that work called the Kidmas HaEmet, okay? In which he postulates the following thesis. There's a posik in Vezois HaBrocha, which talks about HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving the Torah at Sinai, and it says, Eish Das Lamoi. Eish Nafs. And the Torah, he says, is described as Eish Das. Okay? Which, interestingly, is written in the Chumash as two words. It's written actually with a little line there, but it's pronounced Eish Das. What is Eish Das? I mean, sometimes Simchas Torah morning is a little bit of a balagam to try and sit and analyze the Pesukim, but Vasoisa Brocha is a parasha worth analyzing, as are they all. Eish Das, what's Eish Das? So it says in the Sif, Eish Das is fire, and what's Das? Religion. It's a fire religion. Fire religion. Says in the Sieve, what you have here are the two paradigms of the way that Torah works. There's the Eish element, which is constantly renewing, which is constantly burning up what was there before, breaking it down, and reconstituting it into a new format. And then there's the Das element, which is saying, no, this is the tradition. This is what we have done. This is what we will do. We pass down from our ancestors down to our grandchildren. Says the Netziv, throughout Jewish history, these two approaches to Psak, Halacha, have always been coming up against each other in different ways. And he goes through and he explains how this works. He explains this being the approach of Yehuda versus the approach of Levi and the Kohanim. He says this is the approach of Beis Hillel versus Beis Shammai. Hillel is Eish, to Shammai is Das. He says this is the Gemara of the Talmud Bavli versus the Talmud Yerushalmi. He says this is the Ga'anim versus Tosfos. It's very interesting how you can see this playing through the whole of Jewish history, that there have been elements in society in different times swinging different ways. Sometimes the Jewish people undergoes an enormous upheaval in Halacha, which is an Eish upheaval, like Tosfos, where Tosfos come along and say, okay, fine, Masorah, very nice, but we're going to reanalyze the Gemara, and we're going to clash everything together, break it all down, and come up with a new Halacha. And we saw, it's not coincidental, we saw in the first few Shiurim, it was often Tosfos who were the ones that turned around and said, the reason that the Halacha in Chazal was X, the reason no longer applies, we need a new Halacha for today. And they brought a new Halacha. My Machronim, out. My Megulim, out. Clapping and dancing, allowed. Yeah? All of these things that we saw time after time after time after time is a reinvention on some level of, not a complete reinvention, but a new approach to Chiddush. Whereas Das is very much this is the way we always did it. By the way, don't always think that Das is Machmer and Eish is Mekel. It's not a question of lenience and not lenient. In many ways, what the Mishnah Brura did, when the Mishnah Brura revolutionized to some degree the modern way that we pass in Halacha, he is very much a process of Eish, which he said, you know, I don't so much care how people have been doing things in Lithuania for the last 200 years. That's more the Orach HaShulchan, who says, look, the Minag is this, and this is what we did. The Mr. Brewer comes along and says, but I want to analyze all the Rishonim, and we'll come to a new Psak, and maybe we have to be more Machmir these days. And we have to look, to some degree, maybe we will in Source 8, in Shia 8, at Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's Rupture and Reconstruction, which was a classic essay on this issue around 20 years ago. Why does it feel like everything's getting more Machmir these days? I'm sure you've had that feeling every now and then. Yeah? Does it just feel that way? Or is it that way? And if it's that way, why is it that way? And where's that coming from? Is that coming from Das or is that coming from Eish? Okay? So I want to make you aware at least that what we're really dealing with in Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Yeshua, is not just them. It's a whole approach. And therefore, when you're looking at the question of how does Psak work, you always have to be thinking a little bit about this. Where is this coming from? Are we trying to uphold our minhagim that we've had? Or are we trying to reinvent things, either more lenient or more strict, depending on how the perspective is, in that way? So I just wanted to bring that to your attention, because that's very, very critical. Just turn for a second to page 5. Let's look at Rav Shechter before we go back to Rav Lichtenstein a little bit later. He talks about Chiddush. He produced this about 6 months ago in an article in Jewish Action, where Jewish Action carried three articles, one by Rav Shechter, one by Rav Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, and also one by a very special young Talmid Chochem called Rabbi Emanuel Bernstein. Rabbi Emanuel Bernstein, who is one of my personal chaverim and to a certain degree rebbeim, even though he's younger than me, he gives shiurim all over the place, including a shiur in Chumash, I think, every week still. It's very, very worth listening to. He is the son of Rav Rabbi Isaac Bernstein from London, from Ireland originally, who was also an incredibly special person. Rabbi Bernstein also writes an article there on this issue of Masorah and Chiddush. But let's look at what Rav Shechter says. 18. Judaism allows for Chiddush, innovation, but not Shinui, change. Let's see what he means by that. Despite this emphasis on tradition, Judaism is not frozen in place. See Halachic Man Part 2, he says. And the whole of the Part 2 of Halachic Man is dedicated to the concept of Chiddush. That man's very nature in this world, Halachic Man, is to be Mechadesh. Now, how do you put that together with Rav Soloveitchik at the beginning, which says Halacha is this objectified, pre-existing thing, and yet he says that why is it, Rashi's first question on Chumash, why is it that the Torah contains a story of creation? That's a great question, Rashi's first question. And everyone gives different answers to that question. And Rav Soloveitchik's answer to that question is, you see, the Torah wants to show us that God creates the world. He wants to tell us that the human being must be God-like and therefore constantly creating too. And therefore, the whole purpose of the creation story was not to tell us how the world was made. That's just silly. It's to tell us to be people who remake the world constantly. Therefore, Chiddush is essential. How do you know when you're being mechadish something legitimately and when you are changing something illegitimately? Let's have a look what he says. Minor practices such as the design or color of a synagogue's parochus can change easily. Okay, fine. So that's not going to take the halachic process forward in a great leap. Rules that are more rigid must also respond appropriately to changed circumstances. Someone committed to Masorah must inquire of his Rebbe Muvhak to learn when and how to change practices while remaining within traditional attitudes and patterns of behavior. So the first thing he says is, and this is all obvious, we can't be making these decisions as to halachic change ourselves. You can't have people who don't know what they're doing saying, well, I think this, and I mean, the wonderful thing about the Jewish people is everyone has an opinion, right? Everyone has an informed opinion about the halachic process, even if they know nothing about the halacha whatsoever. It's rather the equivalent of someone walking into the NASA space program and saying, I don't know what all this complicated stuff is about. It's very straightforward. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. That's how cosmology works, and therefore, why do you make life so complicated? Many Jewish people's comments are the Jewish equivalent of that when it comes to halacha. And you know exactly what I mean. Okay? So, what's that? Right. But they doesn't preclude them from having a very clear opinion on what the rabbis are doing. Okay, fine. We're not talking about those people. We're talking about someone who's a Rebbe Muvhak, someone who you go to, who gives you guidance on these things, who knows the halachic system well. So that's very clear. By the way, you should know that Rav Shechter himself, on the question of women rabbis, came out extremely, extremely negatively. And we'll look a little bit at that. He said, it's Yeharig Val Yavor. And we'll see why he said that. Well, what? I don't like these labels. I don't like these labels. I think they are... We'll see a little bit on that. Just like science progresses, so too halacha advances. He's treading a difficult path. He's committed to the idea of chiddush. The psak works, and again, we're not talking about psika. Psika we'll look more at next time. But psak works through a process of chiddush. Rabbis are constantly reinventing, reanalyzing. We'll see how they do in a minute. And yet, he doesn't want to turn around and say nothing ever changed. If you want to talk about quotes and quotes Haredi, well, there's not really a Haredi approach. Some people have the approach to halacha, which is nothing ever changed. Moshe Rabbeinu got the halacha on Harsina, nothing's ever changed since. That's just ridiculous. That's not an informed understanding of halacha. Anyone can open a page of Gemara and realize that's not the case. So he's trying to understand how halacha changes while still holding a line. The Midrash states there is no day in which God does not innovate the halacha in the heavenly court. Similarly, Yaakov Shimoni explains the verse Yivcha Elohim Chadashim, they chose new gods, Potikin Shoftim, as Yivchar Elohim Chadashim. God chooses new things. God appreciates Chidushim. God doesn't want sterility. The Rav would often say that Judaism allows for Chiddush, innovation, but not Shinui, change. See Halachic Mind, and from there you shall seek. From there you shall seek is a translation that was brought out posthumously of the Rav's essays on various philosophical issues. It's very well worth buying. I've brought you, which I'm not going to have time today to go through in detail, though I may point out something, on page 6, you'll see I've brought you page 108 from
from there you shall seek, which is the Rav on the process of Chiddush, which we may just look at very briefly if we have time at the end, but I've left that for you to think about yourself. Not every Chiddush, look at the third paragraph, not every Chiddush, however, is acceptable. Tosfos, and here's an interesting question, Tosfos note a contradiction between two Talmudic passages. The Gemara in Pesachim 50b states that one should learn Torah even without proper motivation, because from doing so he will eventually arrive at the proper motivation. We know this. Mitosho lolishma, lolishma. In contrast, the Gemara in Bracha states that he who studies Torah with the wrong motivation would have been better off never having been born, which it does. The Netziv resolves this contradiction by explaining that learning extant Torah without issuing a new ruling or an innovative interpretation is permissible even amidst it, regardless of motivation. If I want to learn existing Torah, then I can do it without good motivations. Okay, that's not ideal. I should do it with good motivations. But better, I should do it even with bad motivations, because that will bring me to good motivations. However, Chidushei Torah, creating new interpretations, requires the proper motivation, and if done with the wrong intention, is spiritually poisonous, because the practitioner biases his judgment towards his personal desires. And this is an important point, which is the process of both Psak and Psika, but he's talking about Chiddush in Psak. There has to be an analysis of the motivation of the person. Where are they coming from? And that's very, very hard. Because what agendas do people have? And if they're not conscious of their agendas, that makes it even worse. Have a look back at Rabbi Lichtenstein. Just go back and we'll pick up an important point that we didn't yet deal with. If you turn, please, on page 3, please. Have a look in number 9. There are imminent questions. These are imminent questions to be honestly and conscientiously confronted. And surely we have no right to demand of a Pesach, almost as a matter of moral and personal right, the most comforting answer. The answer is not always going to be the answer that you want. If that's the kind of Pesach you want, then that's not the halachic process. That's just a sham. And he deals now with Blue Greenberg's infamous statement. The notion that, quotes, where there is a rabbinic will, there is a halachic way, unquotes, both insults Gedolei Torah, collectively, and in its insouciant view of the totality of halacha, verges on the blasphemous. It says you can't say that, because that implies that everything is open. If the rabbis just wanted to do it, then there would be a halachic way to do it. This is not a legitimate halachic approach. That doesn't, of course, mean that the rabbis have no discretion, but that approach is not legitimate. What we do expect of a Pesach is that he walk the extra mile, wherever for him it may be, harnessing knowledge and imagination in an attempt to abide by his responsibility to both Torah, with which he has been entrusted, and to his anguished fellow whose pangs he has internalized. And he's talking more about the psika now, but insensitive psika is not only lamentable apathy or poor public policy, it is bad halacha. If you're not sensitive, he says, that's not just unfortunate, it's bad halacha. To the extent that Kovod Abrius, for example, permits a violation, be it of a Rabbanon injunction, actively, or of a Doraisa passively, and we'll deal with that in the future classes, failure to act on that principle undercuts a spiritual ideal. The Rav was fond of quoting the Chafetz Chaim to the effect that interruption of Kriya Shema, where enabled, mipnei hakovod, was not permissible but mandatory. In other words, you're not frummer if you refuse to interrupt your davening to speak to someone when the halacha says you're allowed to. It is bad halacha to ignore that because you have misunderstood. This actually happened to me on Shabbos. I went up to someone when they were saying a part of the davening that is very easily interrupted and there's no halachic problem with it at all. And they just ignored me and continued davening. Now, okay, fine, maybe I was insensitive for speaking to them while they were still saying Elaine or whatever it is, but that was completely the wrong halachic approach, to just ignore someone. I mean, just ignore somebody. It's not frumma to do that. It's like bad halacha. If you don't take into account the Kovod Abrius angles, then that's not called more, that's not called stricter. That's just called wrong. Okay? And he brings at the end of that particular area, he brings Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach as prime exemplars
exemplars rather of this. I remember a situation that I was told about Rav Shlomo Zalman. This is a classic Rav Shlomo Zalman. He said the following: are you allowed to give food to a person who will not make a brocha on that food? Just pass a piece of cake to them. They won't make a mazonas. Shulchan Aruch deals with the shaila and says clearly you're not allowed. It's litnei iver. How can you give food to someone who's not going to make a brocha on it? Came someone to visit the yeshiva in Kol Torah, non-religious person, and Rav Shlomo Zalman gave him food and gave him drink. He didn't make a brocha. He said thank you very much, and he left very happy. The Talmidim came to Rav Shlomo Zalman and said to him, get him before the Shulchan Aruch. It's osir. It's an aveira to give a person. It's litnei iver. So he said, Rav Shlomo Zalman said to him, you know something, litnei iver is very, very choshev. We have a choice. Either we cause the man to leave the Beis HaMedrash having not made a mazonas and not made a shahakol, which would definitely be a problem. Or we don't give him food and drink and we cause him to leave the Beis HaMedrash hating Orthodox Jews and saying, how could anybody not offer a person a simple glass of water and a cookie on a hot day in the summer? Which do you think is a bigger litnei iver? Yes. But he did it, Lamais. He did it. It's better than upset. You know something? That's the basis of the whole heter of Kiruv. How do I invite people to my Shabbatonim on Shabbos when they're going to drive? Why is that not litnei iver? That's a big question. But one of the answers to that question is, litnei iver doesn't just involve the technical halachic shaila that you're dealing with right here and right now. It involves a much bigger picture of what's going to be the consequence of not doing this or of doing it the other way, and that's something that we need to talk about. I can't speak for Gedolim. I don't know. Really? I'm not sure. I don't think Gedolim Yisrael are insensitive. Chas v'chalilah. Maybe. Some would have seen it slightly differently. But it's a question of emphasis. But nobody would have ignored totally the human aspect. They may have weighed it up and decided that one was more important than the other. Why? He's dealing with a different kind of person. That's going to have to be your answer. He's dealing with a person who is not making brochas because they've rejected Judaism and they know they should make brochas and they don't care and they're not interested and therefore, you know, why should I go out of my way to help such a person? As opposed to a person who is uneducated, is open to be, you know, brought closer to Judaism and is simply not making brochas because no one ever taught them how to make brochas. Maybe we have a different situation today. Yes.
Right.
Well, that's upset because it's in an objective format.
Okay. But the question is, when can we go over that line and say, like in this case, is it a psak halachy enough for the
Gemara? But that's the point. It's not going over the line, unless you understand what he calls the psika, which is all the other factors. The Shulchan Aruch is a halachic textbook. It doesn't tell you how to paskin halacha to this person. So this person, you have to also bring into account all the other meta-halachic issues. You cannot. You cannot paskin a halacha from the Shulchan Aruch. You have to know the entire body of halacha. That's because many halachas do not have this external seeker element to them. Whether how I lay the cutlery out on the table on Shabbos morning, within a way which is boreh friendly or not boreh friendly, that doesn't always have a but. Some do. For example, someone makes me a cup. This happened to me. Someone makes me a cup of tea on Shabbos. Someone says, would you like a cup of tea? And I, at the end of the meal, I said, ooh, lovely, yes, thank you very much. And I see them go, this is a post, someone show me Shabbos, and I see them put a tea bag in a glass, put it under the urn, and go like this on top of the tea bag. Now, that person considers themselves a Shomer Shabbos. They just, you know, they didn't know this halacha. Very good. There's lots of halachas that we don't know as well. So, now what am I going to do? This is not a machlokas, by the way. Pouring directly from an urn onto a tea bag is Bishul Daraisa. There's no shaila. Now, they already cook the tea in the tea bag. Ah, that's nice. Same Bishul Acha Bishul. The Israeli tea has been cooked to pieces. That's why he doesn't make tea.
I always wondered why Israeli tea bags were different from PG tips.
By the way, Agav, I know, and of course this will go no further than this room, and no names will be mentioned, I know a very significant godel in Yerushalayim that whenever anyone's coming from England, always orders English tea bags to be brought to him rather than the Israeli ones. So I won't talk about who that is. Now, so good. So what am I going to do there? So there's a klip, sak halacha. This has been brought, you know, cooked on Shabbos, and stuff which has been cooked on Shabbos, they're not allowed to eat. The question is, well, how does that work? Is there a b'dievet situation? Under what circumstances is the b'dievet situation relevant? Does the covered habrius, does the embarrassment of rejecting this cup of tea somehow put me in a b'dievet situation which allows me now to rely on a p'sek which is not brought in the Shulchan Aruch? The Shulchan Aruch very clearly said you can't drink the tea. However, there is a p'sek out there, the Vilna Gaon, that would say that in b'dievet situations you could drink the tea. Now, when am I allowed to use that to reach out, bring in that minority opinion, and when am I not? And how does that work? That's a classic example of a situation which can arise, even in Hilchos Shabbos. And if you look it up in Shmiras Shabbos Kilchasai, I'm not sure you'll get exactly the full answer. That's why halacha is more than just looking things up in books. That's why they didn't want to write the oral Torah down. Because once you write things down, things become lost between the cracks. Let's just continue a little bit. So, I drank the tea, and there's reasons why I drank the tea. Yes, and it was delicious. Okay, let's just move on. Let's just have a look also at what he says. In number 10, I'll draw that to your attention, where he talks about also the Pesek's agenda and whether he's influenced by cultural forces. Just like Rav Shechter said, they have to be very, very aware. If he's unaware of his agenda, then things are going to go wrong. I just want to finish with one other thing, which is this. Actually, two other things. How do we relate to Rav Soloveitchik's approach in the human terms? So we saw Rav Soloveitchik at the very beginning, which was this sort of objective, very almost like sort of emotionless halachic system. Have a look for a second, because I don't want to leave you with that impression, on page 3, on the third paragraph of source number 8, where Rav Lichtenstein says the following. It is sometimes thought that the Rav was opposed to this approach, meaning the approach of the human concept of Psak. To the best of my knowledge, this assumption is primarily based on a page drawn from Maido Dech Midoi, in which he emphatically rejects the notion that psychosocial elements are factored into the halachic process and affect its course. We saw something very similar at the beginning. He rejected psychosocial elements totally. Several sentences in this vein are admittedly sharp and sweeping. So he says, yes, Rav Soloveitchik sounds very sharp and sweeping. And yet, careful examination of this tenuously balanced passage reveals that its primary thrust is not denial of human considerations, but insistence on the autonomy of halacha. He's fighting where there is a rabbinic will, there is a halachic way. That's what he's doing. Commiseration is acknowledged as a legitimate factor, stimulating the Posek's quest for a solution, but is barred as a component of the halachic process proper once this has been set in motion. What Rav Lichtenstein actually very, very carefully is trying to do here is trying to say, don't think that Rav Soloveitchik doesn't believe in psika. Of course he does. Of course he believes that when you have a psak, you have to apply that sensitively with all of the other meta-halachic issues which go into it. But what Rav Soloveitchik is really railing against is this idea that psak itself can be manipulated by agendas, and we can start, you know, creating chidushim because we feel that egalitarianism is in, or that this is in, or that that's in. And therefore, that's where he's coming from. So I don't think you should feel, and I think that's what Rav Lichtenstein is saying, that Rav Soloveitchik is this kind of faceless, cold, analytical, you know, halacha machine. Halachic man is not a machine. It's not called halachic machine. It's called halachic man. Okay? And therefore, I think that's important to understand. What he is saying is that where there is a halachic will, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, is very problematic. I once had a conversation with somebody about mechitzas in shul. And there was an attempt to try and make the mechitzas more women-friendly. What do I mean by that? And this is a legitimate approach. This was a shul in which the mechitzas were at the back, and the women sat at the back, and the men sat at the front. And the question was, they were trying to get the rabbi to agree to move the mechitzas around the side, so the women would be not just at the back, looking over the mechitza, but around the side, and a little bit more involved in the, if you like, the service. Would the rabbi agree to this or not? So I was having a discussion with this person as to, you know, what did the rabbi say and how did the rabbi view this, etc., etc. And they were getting very frustrated by the rabbi's sort of reluctance to start messing around with the mechitzas. I'm not getting into the merits of the case here. And I said to them, well, do you think that the rabbi, do you think you may be able to get the rabbi to take the mechitzas down completely? To which their answer was, not yet. What that clearly showed is that that particular person, and I'm not blaming them, and I'm not suggesting that they're, you know, bad people, but they were coming from very much the, well, it's just the rabbinic will. If there's a rabbinic will, of course there's a halachic way. They're just making self-fashion, they're making life hard for people, they're just being too kind of restrictive, and they need to be a little bit more open to modern realities. That obviously is a conservative and reform approach, and we'll look at that in more detail, and that's what Rav Soloveitchik is fighting against. I just want to bring your attention on the last thing, to the last source I brought you on page 5 in the last 3 minutes. This is a very interesting analysis, and I just want to bring your attention to this book, because this book is also important on this issue. Professor Rabbi Dr. Michael J. Breut is a professor in Emory. He's a dayan on the Rabbinical Council of America. He's a very, very significant Talmud Chacham, and writes very widely for Tradition magazine, and he's very much part of that centrist Orthodox world. He produced a book about a year ago, it's 2010, called Innovation in Jewish Law, a Case Study of Chiddush in Havineinu. What's Havineinu? Havineinu is the short tefillah which the Gemara says can be said in place of all the middle brachas of the Shemona Esrei if a person is in a kind of a bind situation. Now, why did he pick that? So, apart from the fact that it's an interesting issue, he picked it, I think, largely because it is the least controversial issue in the world. Nobody really cares. It's important, halachi, to get it right. But nobody's sitting seething at home worrying about why the rabbis are not being more innovative with Havineinu. And therefore he picked this example to try and make it as like agenda-free as possible, to show you how does the process of Chiddush really work. This spring, this never-ending spring of Chiddush that we talked about. And it's a very interesting book. I can't say I've read the entire thing. But I brought you here at the end from his... you can buy it in Pomerantz down the road. It's not expensive. I brought you from his conclusions here, where he talks about the fact, just look for a second at a couple of these comments in 19, though the Torah is God-given, halacha is neither static nor stagnant. Rather, it demands human involvement. Active study and participation in deriving the halacha from the rabbinic sources are the fundamental components of the halachic process. These endeavors often produce unexpected conclusions. This is the essence of Chiddush. And he tells you in the middle paragraph, and he's not talking about psyche, he's talking about psak, the process of coming to analysis. He says, Chiddush arises in a number of ways. Number one, the halacha is very complex. Number two, some halachic sources are not clear. That's obviously the case. Whenever you analyze a sugya, there are some statements of Rishonim, and it's not entirely clear what they mean. There are also external factors he brings in, of society, technology, economic conditions as well, which is maybe more in the psika realm. But he basically analyzes, and I think it's definitely worth reading, how the process of Chiddush works. And maybe we'll just finish with this final paragraph. While poskim universally aim to explore the concepts behind rules, their approaches differ. For example, when faced with a contradiction between two sources, among several commentaries, or between practice and law, poskim exhibit two primary approaches: harmonization, where a posek rereads the text to minimize and resolve contradictions, and ruling where a posek simply accepts one opinion over another. In other words, part of the way that halacha is created is you have this source that says X, this source that says Y, they don't match, but I can find a way to make them match, but that produces Z, which was neither X nor Y. That's now part of the halachic process, because it says it's a textual analytical process which says text A says this, text B says this. The way I resolve them is by the following, and that may even be something which is new. Now, alternatively, he could just say text A says B, text A and text B. We paschalize text A, in which case, you know, that becomes the halacha. But this process is a very detailed process, and it's part of the process of chiddush. By analysis, by textual rules. How do you understand any text? When you sit and learn Chumash, rationality, by your brain, by a process, by a combination of your own understanding of how to read and how to understand and how you've been taught to analyze these texts. So that comes in as well. So I want to leave it there, and I want to basically outline what I'll be doing for the final four sessions. As I said on the original outline, in source 7, I would like to look a little bit at the issue of meta-halacha and how that works, where these extra-halachic or global halachic principles come from. I would also like to look a little bit at some of the more, you know, modern controversial issues and how they're being fought in terms of halachic change. And, you know, ending up with, I'd like to look forwards to the process of halachin Yemos HaMashiach, and whether we can really envisage or expect a wholesale halachic revolution when we move forward to this messianic process, which will be quite interesting to look at. Okay, we'll leave it there. I wish you all a wonderful Pesach, HaKashav HaSameach, and we'll speak soon.